everyone, and welcome back to Murder, She Spoke, the podcast that discusses Murder, She Wrote episodes. Today we're discussing Season 1, Episode 2, The Murder of Sherlock Holmes, Part 2. Now, in the last episode, you'll probably want to watch that if you haven't. This episode is obviously a continuation of that. And in the beginning, when you first start playing the video on Amazon Prime, if that's where you're watching it, they finally give you the option. They give you an option to skip the intro, which is 44 seconds long. And then when the show starts, there is a recap of what happened in the last episode. And there is a button that says skip recap, which is so cool. I didn't see that ever before. Alright, so we're starting off strong. Grady, Jessica Fletcher's nephew, is implicated in murder. And Jessica is in a cab with Preston, which I finally remembered his name. They're driving. I don't know where yet. But he realizes that when she found out that Grady was arrested, she was on her way to get on the train, and he was, like, offended, kind of, because he's really into her, and he was like, you weren't even gonna tell me goodbye, and she was, like, real awkward about it, and then he was like, you know, he just laid his feelings right out on the table. He was like, I thought, we had a thing going, and she was like, no, we did, but she clearly didn't want to, like, face it. She then explains why she didn't, like, pursue anything with him, because she said, flowers who bloom too soon are something susceptible to a early frost or a late frost or something, and clearly she just means, like, this is, like, too intense too fast. Like, she clearly is really into him. When the cab pulls over and Preston gets out, it's so freaking adorable that he's like, do you want to have dinner? And then she's like, kind of like, almost it looks like she's kind of teary-eyed, like, almost. And then he's like, come on. And then she's like a nerd. Like, she's like, all right. Like, really excited, shaking her head like a little kid. It's so cute. Right after that, 5 minutes in, we have a New York stereotype. The driver, rough and tumble. I think he's Italian. And she asks if he knows a place. And he's like, listen, lady. Like, stereotypical of the 80s, early 90s, like, a cab driver. And next scene is Jessica hitting up a yacht club. This is the first real instance of her doing some investigating, and she is jumping right in. She immediately finds Captain Caleb's, the captain. She finds his yacht. Okay, so she confronts Captain Caleb about, what if it's, she's trying to clear her nephew's name, obviously, and she casually discusses, like, she doesn't, like, she jumps right into it, but she's, like, pretty casual about it, like, saying, the whole thing is wrapped around, there being a mole in his company, his chowder house company, and him trying to flush the mole out, and he believes that Grady was the mole, and the fact that they caught him and he caught the detective in his room caused him to kill the detective because he thought the detective found out that he was stealing the secrets, but Jessica doesn't believe that he was stealing any secrets, and she is convinced of something else. And she mentions that, was it possible that Captain Caleb was the actual target because the detective was killed while wearing the Sherlock Holmes costume, which in the previous episode we learned that's the outfit Captain the captain had been wearing all night until he left with the girl he was cheating on his wife with. So there, Jessica's trying to establish that the actual target of the shooter, the murder, was actually the captain. She brought it up casually to the captain, and then kind of stepped back to make him think that she wasn't pursuing it any longer. But what I would have done personally, I would have brought up the issue the same way she did. But then I would have been like, okay, it probably wasn't, you probably weren't the target exactly like she did. But then I would have said, you know, I mean, let's say for instance that you might have been the target. That means that you're still a target. Or I would have said something like, oh, that's good. You don't think that you're the target, because that could have been really dangerous for you. And he would have been like, wait, what do you mean? And I would have been like, well, if you were the target originally and they realized they shot the wrong guy, you're going to still be the target. Like, and that would cause him to worry a little bit. And then he might actually help her clear Grady's name based off of that theory. So based off of what the captain said, that he set a trap for the people he believed were stealing his information. And it was between six people. He narrowed it down to three. Now it's narrowed down to two, either Grady or Ashley Vickers. Now, Ashley Vickers is the one with the big collar that was cheating with the captain. Cheating on the captain. Well, the captain was cheating on his wife with Ashley for many years. And then Ashley saw him cheating on her with a young blonde girl. And she is one of the two suspects that could have gotten the information. But her alibi is that she was with Jessica at the time. Now, that's at the time that they believe the shot was heard, which I'm sure will come into play at some point. So Jessica runs into her hotel room, again, her hearing a phone call and her bursting through the door. She answers the phone, it's Grady. Now, Grady must have gone through some crazy shit in his life, because he was arrested for murder earlier on, that I'm pretty sure the same day, and he's just like in his house, apartment or whatever, casually watching like a baseball game, just being real chill about everything, not worried at all, which I mean makes sense, because like based on so far, it's assumed that he isn't guilty, but also like he was arrested for murder, so I feel like he should be a little bit more nervous. But Jessica calls all worried, and he's like, hey, you know, chill out. I'm like, what? Now Jessica convinces Grady to break into his office, into the captain's company, which is where Grady worked. I assume he's laid off or fired since the captain believes he was the one stealing his information. Now, the information, he's trying to open up a new chowder plant, and the information is what locations he was looking to buy, because then the person who took those locations, they were able to buy the property that he was looking at, and then they wanted to be able to buy the property at a low price and sell it back to him at a really high price to make a lot of money, which makes sense. So now Jessica and Grady are in Ashley's office. I assume she's higher up in the chowder company. I believe she is Grady's boss. She has a really nice office. And Jessica is straight up, like, not sneaking around. Grady's trying to be quiet. And Jessica's like, no one's here. Who cares? Be as loud as you want. Which is hilarious. I hate scenes like this. Because, If you're not a police officer and you're sneaking around, you're gonna get caught. And that is, like, such a anxiety-filled moment for me. Like, a lot of times when I'm watching episodes like this, and I'll, like, skip through just to make sure they weren't caught, and then I can watch it, like, and be relaxed. Because that's a lot for me. But yeah, so right now they're looking at who the actual who bought the land. Because that Jessica believes that whoever bought and resold the land is who will lead them to proof of the killer or whatever. So while they're sneaking around, guess who comes in? Crap, what's her name? Amanda? And oh my gosh, I can't remember her name. I've been saying it for like, well, the lady they are searching her office, she came in. Jessica ran off and hid in her closet. A lot of suspense here. So she comes in and opens a secret compartment in her desk, pulls out a book, and then gets a phone call of, which establishes that Jessica was in fact right, that this girl was involved with stealing the information and passing it on. But, of course, she had an alibi because she also had an accomplice. So, apparently, she is in, right now in this episode, it is assumed that she and one other person are involved with the taking of information, selling it, and then killing the private detective. Though we don't know for sure if they intended to kill the PI or they intended to kill the captain. And honestly, like, someone who is so thorough to get their own alibi, like, why would they take a phone call like that? That the phone call, literally, she's like, I told you not to call me here. And then she's like, I don't want any part of murder. Like, first of all, if I answered the phone and it was my accomplice freaking out, I would be like, calm down, I'll take care of it. And then I'd hang up, or I would answer and, like, I wouldn't just answer and then hang up on them when I realized who it was, because, like, an accomplice who is really panicky could mean easily mean they go to the police and ruin the whole operation. So I'd probably be like, don't worry about it, I'll take care of it, you know. I wouldn't tell them to meet me anywhere right away because, I mean, obviously Jessica is hearing her say, okay, I'll meet you here at blank, whatever, and then I feel like Jessica's gonna follow them, and then she'll find out who the accomplice is, and that's, like, a pretty easy solve. So I'd probably be like, okay, don't worry, I am at my office right now, or something, and I will call you when I get home, or I'd say something like, I will come see you right away and we can talk about it. Like, I'd reassure them rather than, I mean, we'll see what happens. I don't know. I did have seen this episode before, but it has been so long. Like, I honestly don't remember what exactly happens. So, based on what I've seen already are the assumptions that I'm making and, my opinions. I'm not basing off of what happens later. Okay, so the next scene, it jumps from Amanda, I think that's her name. She's on the phone with the accomplice, and then she hangs up. She reveals that she thinks she's being followed, or she could be being followed, obviously. So she leaves the office, and freaking 2 seconds after this lady gets off the elevator and walks past the security guard down a long hallway, Jessica is following her, and she said to the, she, like, yells out to the security guard, and this lady, like, has to be, like, 2 feet in front of her, but you can't see because it's, like, that's where the camera is, but you, like, it doesn't make any sense because this lady, like, it's elevators at the very, like, the camera is facing the elevators. And between the camera and the elevators is the security desk. And it's very obviously, like, a long hallway up into the front doors. This lady just passes the security desk as Jessica gets off the elevator, yells to the security guard, "Thanks, nice to meet you, Tom." And this lady had to have heard her, had to have seen her, but according to the episode, she must have not. She must have quickly left the door. But, like, if I heard any noise like that at that time of night in her office, I would have immediately turned around. But, especially because she knew Jessica, Jessica gave her her alibi. So, one, she probably would have recognized your voice, and two, even if she hadn't, if she turned around, she would have been like, "What the hell, Jessica, what are you doing?" But I'm sure Jessica would have talked her way out of it anyway, saying she was trying to warn her or something. But the most ridiculous part is she runs after her and sees her get onto a bus. But obviously she can't get on the same bus. So she tries to hail a taxi and no one's stopping for her. She is in the middle of the damn road. Stop. Like, honestly, like, it is so insane. Like, she's an insane person. Like, she's standing in front of cars that are going really fast, and she keeps trying to hail a taxi. And honestly, it's no wonder that no one would stop for her. She looks crazy. Then she finally stops a taxi and asks him to follow the bus. And he's like, "No, I know where that's going." Like, he's saying it's going really far. He's not going to bother following it. But, like, she... Like, I would have gotten into the cab first and said, "Can you, go..." I would have just been like, "Keep going straight," or "Follow that bus." I don't know. It's so cliche, like, "Follow that car." I mean, he's getting paid. I don't know why he wouldn't do it. That's money. But then she gets... the cab pulls off, and then a bus comes barreling towards her. And, oh my gosh. She was, like, waving to the bus, which is, like, 2 inches from her face. Then she runs to the doors and pounds on them like a lunatic. Oh, my goodness. So she gets on the bus after banging on the door, which the bus doesn't even stop for that long to pick up passengers. So I'm assuming that wasn't one of its stops. But she asks if his bus goes to the same place as the bus she's chasing. And he's like, "Yeah." So, I mean, it's been like 2 seconds since the last bus left, so I doubt, maybe it's going the same place, but that's not one of its normal stops. But guess who the bus driver is? None other than the guy who plays, okay, so if you've seen The Golden Girls, you know that Dorothy Swornack is played by Bea Arthur. Well, her ex-husband in the show is, this is who the bus driver is. And that's why I like this show a lot, too. Because it's very reminiscent of, like, BBC detective shows, like Midsummer Murders. And then the Canadian Murdoch Mysteries version of a detective. But it's, like, Canada actor-based. And then there's, you know, Poirot, Sherlock Holmes, all of those. But, like... like in Poirot and, oh, Father Brown, Miss Fisher, but Miss Fisher is actually Australia, but it's all, like, from the BBC that's sort of, like, there are tons of, you'll see young British actors that are now famous within episodes of those shows, like, especially the ones that have been going on for a really long time. Like, Midsummer Murders is, like, a billion seasons, and so is Poirot. So those are really great, because they you see young British actors that are now famous in those episodes. But this Murder, She Wrote is the American version of that. So throughout Murder, She Wrote, it has the same tone as those British set episodes, but not only that, it has young and old actors, like, up-and-coming actors that I think, like, even George Clooney's in one of the episodes. There are a bunch of, like, What's his name? It's not Bill Murray, it's Bill. He does like that talk show that I honestly can't remember his name, but there are a lot of actors that are now pretty famous that were in these episodes. And even like the guy who plays Dorothy Spornak's husband is the bus driver. Obviously, he's not young, but like after his famous roles, he's here. So like it's like a resting place for actors on their way to or to and from different things. And later on in the season, the sheriff of Cabot Cove, where Jessica lives, is Tom Bosley, and there are a lot of like very famous actors. Like in season two, there's a character that's introduced. His name is Dr. Seth Hazlitt, and he is played by a very famous, well, people now wouldn't recognize him, but he was very well known, very well educated, and theatrical actor play. He performed in a lot of plays. Honestly, I can't remember his name right now, but very well known at the time. And like the guy who played the father in the Addams Family, he's also in several episodes in later seasons. So there. Oh, and Shirley Knight, and then the guy who played the main character, the main man in Green Acres. I honestly can't remember his name, but he's also in I think one episode. So it's really cool to see a lot of different people in there. Okay, back to the story. Now, Jessica is on the bus. There are a bunch of bus passengers, which I didn't notice before. And then she's yelling at the bus driver suddenly that she needs to get off the bus. And because what happens is she sees, what's her name, get off the Amanda, get off the bus. But her bus isn't stopping at the same stops, which is consistent with what happened earlier. So she screams to have the bus driver stop her at what seems to be a shady part of town, and the camera focuses on this young boy, probably like early teen, late teens, watching her, and he like changes his seat when she's yelling to get off the bus. So they let her off the bus, which is so unrealistic. And they show a very cool, like, sort of noir scene where she gets off the bus, but they only show her feet, and she does this cool little thing where, like, I don't know, she's a really good actor. She makes her feet move in a way that it seems dramatic, which is really cool. So they're watching her feet, and she's walking off into a sketchy part of town, and the boy from the bus, they only show his feet at this time, and they show that those feet, which they are following her. Of course, it's New York City, and as soon as she walks down a dark alley, two guys try to mug her. And they're like super nice about it, trying to reason with her. Like, she's trying to like convince them she has a phone in her purse that she's gonna call the police. And the one tough guy is played by Andy Garcia. They're like trying to mug her. It gets really weird. Fucking boss ass bitch that she is. She tells them she has a phone in her purse, then grabs her purse and hits them both. Clearly not very hard, but they probably weren't expecting it, and she books it. Now, what happens is they were kind of giving her an easy time, which was kind of kish. But then, this is why I love this show, because it is so real, though. So she hits them with her purse, and rather than just getting away like a cheesy TV show, they fucking grab her and they wrap her up hard. Then they grab her body and just drag her into, like, a even darker corner of the alley, and they really fuck with her. Like, they are aggressive, like, realistic, and they shove her against the wall, and he pulls out a knife, and he's like, I'm gonna give you a blood test and steal your purse. So, like, this is real. This isn't, like, happy-go-lucky, like, fantasy murder mystery. This is some dark shit. They really fuck with her. So, the kid from the bus, he ends up coming up and fucking annihilating the robbers. Honestly, I'd have to say that while he's beating them up, Jessica's face, she is, like, disgusted, terrified, like, honestly, she clearly is naive. It isn't the show being all happy-go-lucky, it's her. Like, she straight up wasn't ready for New York City. She's used to Cabot Cove, everything. It is a picturesque town in New England, in Maine, and everyone knows everyone, everyone's nice. She was not ready for a ghetto street in New York City, and you can very easily tell that she was not ready for that, or expected it at all. When the man is done beating up the other two guys, he comes to Jessica, and it is almost like it's alluding to the fact that he might fucking kill her. But no, he comes up to Jessica, and Jessica, freaking Angela Lansbury, is such a fucking good actress. She is usually fun-loving, but in this scene, you can tell she is freaking terrified. She looks at him like he has her life in his hands, and she is just waiting to see what he says. And then he says, are you okay? And, like, she starts to cry, and she takes a deep breath, and she's, like, crumpled in the corner of this alley, and it is so good. Now, that is a real dark moment, and this man, he picks her up off the ground and helps her hobble her way back to the street. And they reveal that he is actually the boy from the bus, and he knows her because he read her book, and it's so adorable. And it's really hilarious because once they get out to the street, she seems to be pretty alright. But she doesn't know why the man knows her. He calls her Mrs. Fletcher, and she's like, how do you know me? And he's like, I read your book. And she's like, yeah, but I still don't understand. Like, she still didn't know why he knew her, and she's like, dude, you're a celebrity. And then points, and there's a newspaper clipping of her, like, posted to a wall or something. But it's great because it wasn't, like, these clean, great, you know, random pictures of, you know, Jessica Fletcher best, or J.B. Fletcher bestseller. It's a grade old gross newspaper, like, stuck to the wall, or, like, advertisement, but they have someone graffitied with a mustache on her face. And honestly, if that isn't a freaking realist thing. So he's like, you're famous, and he points to the thing. She turns around and sees the picture of her with a mustache, and she just, like, laughs her ass off. Okay, next scene. I've been calling her Amanda. Her name's Ashley, the lady she was following. Anyway, after that insane encounter in the alley, we see Grady, Kitty, and Preston in Jessica's hotel waiting for her, because clearly Grady was able to sneak out of the office building. And I don't know how much time has passed or whatever, but he obviously was separated from Jessica because she hopped on that bus right away. So he went to her apartment to wait for her, and they checked with the desk, and she hadn't come in yet. Jessica, being the bold-ass bitch, awesome boss that she is, they get into her hotel room. It's her, Kitty, Grady, and Preston. And she just calls the chief of police or whatever, and he's in bed because it's like midnight, and she's like, shut your damn mouth. I have some information. And he's like, I have insomnia. And she's like, bitch, fucking listen. So she tells him what she heard, that Ashley pretty much admitted that she stole the information. And she believes that her accomplice is the guy who was dressed up as Scrooge, which is the guy who's mounting a play, as they say. Because where she got off the bus was where the same neighborhood that he is holding auditions for his play that week. So she's very clever, put stuff together very quickly. Especially since she's never been to New York City, and it can be very confusing. So she reveals that she didn't need the information that her and Grady broke into the building for, which is good because Grady fucked it up. She points out the reason that her accomplice had to be the guy who played Scrooge was because she learned that he hasn't had money in ages, and he's a playwright, and he hasn't put on any plays, apparently, or something, that suddenly he now has all the money. It's like $250,000, I've mentioned this last episode, minimum to get that started, and she's like, and suddenly has all this money, so she is convinced she's on the right path. It's really interesting. They couldn't find an audition notice in the paper. Jessica immediately goes over, pulls open the paper, first page she looks at, boom, audition notice. I mean, I know this episode's already really long because it's in two parts anyway, but, like, honestly, they could have given it a little more time, or rather than her finding it, Grady and Kitty had been looking in the newspaper for that. They had been looking in the papers for that specific item for a good couple minutes at this point. So Kitty could have been like, hey, I found it. And it would have been very realistic. But that's not what happened. I don't know what the director or writer was trying to accomplish with that. Maybe that she's clearly the only one who can solve anything. That kind of pointing is only, like, from what I've noticed before, it's only in this first, the first two, well, technically still the first episode. They just really need to establish that Jessica is an amazing, smart detective sort of person. But the detective work in later episodes is much more realistic. But still, this episode is really good. It is very, very good. So they cut to Grady dropping Jessica off at the theater. She goes in, and you see this lady, and honestly, I mentioned in the last episode that I have a hard time telling people apart, and this lady could easily be Amanda, but I don't think it is. Not Amanda, Ashley. I'm pretty sure it's not Ashley, because Ashley, I think, has darker hair, and she looks a lot meaner. So there's this girl who's auditioning, and as a person, personally, I have been a producer in theater, stage shows, stuff like that, and auditions can be rough. This lady is clearly not killing it. Well, she's killing all of her eardrums, really. And the guy who plays Scrooge, I don't know his name, he is sitting at the piano, going through the motions, looking at it, what I assume is his producer or whatever, like, yikes. For me, I would have been like, sing a few bars. If I liked it, I would have had them continue. And if I didn't like it, I would have been like, okay, I've heard enough. But he's really letting her belt out and screech out these notes. So she's very good looking. And the look he gave his producer, I'm assuming He may have had her audition just because he's into her, but I don't know. Okay, I should have waited a second to wait let that scene finish before I commented. But the guy he kept looking at sheepishly wasn't his producer, from what I can tell so far. It is some guy who brought him this girl to audition. And it is hilarious because you want to know who the guy is? The guy is the father, the grandfather on Everyone Loves Raymond. And he is dressed up like a sleazy businessman, whitish tan suit, huge ass cigar. Looks like a pretty shiny shirt. Great stuff. So, he isn't. I don't know why he didn't stop her sooner, but she finished the whole song, and he freaking tells her in a very eloquent, intellectual way that she fucking sucks. And she is, oh man, such a stereotypical, like, Bronx, like. It's so cliche, but like, I don't. She's just horrible, but I think it's funny that the guy that brought her along, he clearly brought her along because he wanted her. He's friends with the guy and he wants her in the show, but like, when he makes it clear that she sucks, the guy doesn't even care. He's like, all right. And then he's like, you got the dough for this? And then the playwright is like, yeah, we're good. So it's clearly like somewhat an it's not obviously not an investor, but it's like someone he is going to be partnered with. They're getting money of some kind. Not sure yet. I love the contrast between Jessica, intelligent detective, and Jessica, little old lady Jessica, like stereotype little old lady Jessica, because she fucking boss ass bitch walks herself into this audition while the man is slumped over the piano, really tired. And as soon as the guy says, you have the dough, right? And he's like, yeah, I got the dough. And then Jessica appears in the doorway like an angelic, murder-solving angel and says behind him, where did you get the dough? And it is so, like, cinematic. He turns around and doesn't recognize her voice, which is realistic because the only time he really met her, he was super drunk. So he turns around and she confronts him about the plans that he stole, and he's like, you must be crazy, you know, the usual, like, hey lady, you must be mixed up, blah blah blah. And then she's like, she's very calm and collected, and then she jumps into old lady Jessica and she said, she's like, oh young man, there's a boy's future that stop with all this fiddle faddle. And like, she turns into like some country old lady, which I don't know quite yet what that choice is for. So her country weird thing suddenly stops when she's like, stop all this fiddle faddle, blah blah blah. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he gets really angry. And then Ashley happens to be in the balcony listening. And she's like, oh my gosh, give it up. We're found out. Everyone's gonna find out anyway, just, you know. But it's very obvious that they are alluding to the fact that if they don't come clean, they're gonna be implicated because Jessica thinks because they stole the information, that means they also were the murderers. But they're saying that they stole the information, but they were not the murderers. So, Ashley and the piano guy, they admit to stealing the information, and as they do, Grady bursts in and asks Jessica if she's all right. She plays it real cool, looks at both of them, and is like, yeah, I'm good. And they leave. So, interesting. So the next scene is, so I'm still caught up on the her playing it really cool, then her turning into like this southern old lady, like, and then her turning back into really cool. Like, honestly, maybe she's like really cool in general as a person, but like, as she got older, maybe she turned into that stereotypical, like, grandmother, like, I don't know. You'll have to watch the episode to see what happens. It's a really weird twist. Maybe this whole time she's trying to play it cool because it's a murder, and she's, like, trying to parallel the things she writes. I don't know. Or it was just a horrible writing choice. She's so put together and eloquent. And then in that moment, she just gets so worked up that she, I don't know. I don't know what it is. I may go back and rewatch it. So, keeping the action going, the next scene is the chief detective or chief of police or whatever he is. On the X-ray for Amazon Prime, it says he's the chief. But, like, he's clearly a detective. He's not the chief of police. But, like, maybe he's the chief detective. He kind of looks like George W. Bush. Like, not as good looking, but like he has like a resemblance there. He is go he you see him in this scene. He walks up into the captain's boat, which honestly is very gorgeous. Like the outside kind of looks like shit, and it's like a typical like kind of like run down looking yacht, but the inside is beautiful oak. And there's like I think like cherry wood on the top. Everything is decked out in wood. Freaking gorgeous. This coming scene just made me realize the chief thing. Okay. So the murder took place in a small town outside of New York City. Obviously, I knew it was outside of New York City because it's like an estate, a mansion. Makes more sense now, I get it. He is the chief of police of that small town, but it's such a small town. It's kind of like Cabot Cove, where you've got like, it's bigger than Cabot Cove. It's like him, but he's also the detective sort of deal. And since it's a murder, he probably has, like, he's probably thrown into the detective role, because it's a big deal. And I doubt that small town has a lot of murders. So he's on the boat, and then the police, the New York police, catch him on the boat thinking that he is like a criminal, and then he reveals he's the chief of police. His name's Roy Gunderson. I can never remember the names, even though they say them like a thousand times. So they're like, oh, okay, they check his ID, everything's good. So, what I'm doing is, I don't know if you can tell, but like I'm watching a few minutes of the show and then coming back and discussing it. So like it's fresh in my head and I can talk about every little minute as its own sort of entity. But they go up from the they come up to the deck of the ship, which I find weird because they both say that they received an anonymous tip that there's something they should see on the boat. The chief goes down the stairs and sees blood, but he doesn't make it the whole way down before the police put a gun to his back, turns around, shows him who he is, and then they all go back up, but they don't check downstairs. But then, even though the blood seems to be leading down there, but just by happenstance, the blood is actually, I think the blood is leading up to the deck because he asked them to hoist the mainsail, and the music is so like noir, like dun dun dun, like they roll up the mainsail, and there is the captain's body is rolled up in the mast. And honestly, it would have never occurred to me to roll over, like, over. That would have never occurred to me. Though, he didn't find blood kind of close to the mast, but it wasn't really that close. So, like, honestly, I would have freaking never known to, like, unless I searched the whole boat and I couldn't find any more, like, I don't know. If I had searched the whole boat and saw a few droplets of blood but nothing else, maybe I would have gone for the sail and noticed that it's all clumped up and I would have, like, opened it just to see, but not that quickly. It was not, the finger wasn't pointing to the mast at all. But maybe from his experience, but I can't see him having a lot of experience. He's pretty old. He's probably fought in a few wars. So maybe his personal experience led him to think, hey, check the mast. There's probably a dead body in there. But there definitely was a dead body in there. And the body, they unfurled the mast and the body just, boom, right onto the ground. And it's like, dun, 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 boom. And then you see it's the captain. We find out that he was shot several times in the chest. So there's a quick news clip that says, you know, Caleb McCallan's, the chick captain, his wife is taken to the station for questioning. And then it jumps to the chief of police knocking on Jessica's hotel door. And Preston is there, and he's like, oh, assuming there's something going on. And she's like, real cool, sitting down in the corner. And Caleb is kind of, like, nervous. Or not Caleb. Preston seems nervous and uncomfortable. And she's sitting there like a mafia boss, like, letting the little people panic around her as she rules over her kingdom. And so the detective comes in and says that the homicide department of the New York homicide, whatever, they're taking the case, which it makes realistic sense, since that murder happened in New York City ish so he's going back home, which is the town that Preston's estate is in. But then, like, Jessica's like a fucking boss. She's sitting there super coy, and he's like, it's been an honor to meet you. You can horn in on any of my investigations anytime. And she's like, hey, if you're ever in Maine, I'll cook you up some lobster stew. And she's saying that right in front of Preston. Like, she is flirting with damn near everyone. And it is so boss. There is so much going on in these two episodes that I completely forgot that Preston is the president of the company that represents Jessica's book. And honestly, that makes sense. Like, obviously, Preston is really into Jessica, but it also makes more sense why he's trying to protect her, because that's, like, a cash cow scenario. Like, she is, like, the best book in the country right now, and he's also into her romantically, so it makes sense why he's concerned about her, and he's always around. I totally forgot about that. As when the detective leaves, like, clearly, like, his publishing house clearly is in charge of her book. He tells her that he's into her officially at this point, and she's like, you're moving too fast. And then he said, I can wait. And then he, you know, says that they'll be working together for years because he's the president of the publishing company that wants her book or has her book. Yeah, they're the ones who published her book. So, very romantic, really cute. Then they kiss. It is really romantic, really, really attractive. Like, they don't make it, like, ew, gross, two old people kissing, which society is, like, so like that. They make it, like, very, very attractively romantic. Like, he is very attractive, and she is pretty attractive. They're both probably 60s, 70s. But the way they film that scene, it is just very, it's very great, especially for cutting out that stigma that old people don't need love to. And honestly, like, I didn't expect to be, like, seeing two old people kiss and think it was pretty hot, but it was, like, it was some Casablanca shit right there. Okay, so, I forgot where I left off. Because I just watched a chunk of the end, and, okay, so Jessica gets on the train, opens up the newspaper, and sees the book beat thing, the Yale Review, and looks at the picture of the writer, and it's Chris something. And as soon as she sees the picture, something clicks, and she runs off the train and goes to the city where Preston's mansion is. Now, she jumps off the train. Not literally, that'd be insane. The train hasn't left yet, so she gets off the train, runs off, and the conductor is clearly on her in her business all the time. But she, like, yells for the conductor and or the engineer or whatever. And she's like, how do you get to, I think it was, I forget, it started with an H. And he told her, and he's like, wait, what are you doing? And then she, like, just books it. And he's like, what about your luggage? And she's like, whatever. So she gets a cab to the mansion. And while she's driving to the mansion, Preston gets a call. I believe it's starting to come together. The lady who writes the Yale Review was supposed to meet Jessica on one of the stops on her train, so she could ride along with her and get an interview while Jessica was still getting home to Maine. Jessica saw the picture of the Yale Review lady. Something clicked, and then so the Yale Review lady, I believe, is the one who called Preston to tell him that Jessica went to his estate instead of taking the train back to Maine. So he immediately flies or drives or whatever out to his estate, where he finds Jessica picking a lock that it's the lock to his, like, shed where he keeps all the equipment for, like, lights, security, all that. And we find out that Jessica is standing on one side of the pool and Preston is standing on the other side, essentially recreating the murder scene, which is very poetic. It's interesting because she is starting to understand what happened. And she yells out to him, like, hey, we can see each other's faces. Clearly, shooting the private eye wasn't a mistake. And he's very casual. He's like, yeah, but Jess, it was overcast then. And she waits. And at 8 o'clock exactly, the lights turn on out around the pool. She has somehow figured out that the lights at the pool turn on at 8, and she asked him when they turn off, and he said midnight, but clearly he didn't realize what that meant. The murder was at 11:15, so Jessica deduced and then tells Preston that the lights were on during the murder, they definitely knew who they were shooting, and that implicates Preston. Now, Preston wants to know why it implicates him, and she establishes that her, Kit, Grady, and Preston were the only ones that knew the private eye was there. And he claims that he doesn't know who the private eye, like, he says, yeah, but I had never met him before. But she starts to explain something interesting. She mentions that the detective, when he was leaving the room, that he guessed that Preston's costume was from the Count of Monte Cristo. And it made, like, this weird, like, connection. And then Jessica revealed that back when she was entering the kitchen with Ashley to, blot out the stain on her dress, Preston was on the phone, and Jessica asked who was on the phone, and he said, a New York Times reporter, and he's trying to, like, get an interview with you. And Jessica was like, that was a lie, because the New York Times reporter that interviewed me was a woman. So, after she reveals that he could have been the only one that killed the private detective, it's revealed why. Preston was implicated in a scandal that he was with three other business partners, and he was, like, in some housing development company, and apparently one of the houses collapsed and killed three people, and the business partners were the ones responsible, but he was the scapegoat and got blamed for it and was sentenced to 15 years in prison. But after 2 years, he escaped, and they assumed he had died in the escape attempt because they never found him. So technically, like, the police weren't searching for him because he had died. Which is the connection to the Count of Monte Cristo, because he escapes and everyone assumes, you get it. And that's when the detective, who already knew who he was and was going to blackmail him on that, when he left the room and said, oh, you're the Count of Monte Cristo, it was really haunting. So that night of the party, the PI asked Preston to meet him at the pool. And that's where he mentioned the blackmail, and Preston felt that he had gone through so much. He was accused falsely of and sentenced falsely, and he went through all the trouble to leave that behind him. And so he said he couldn't deal with having to deal with blackmail, so he immediately shot the PI. Honestly, the scene they set here is really great. These whole two episodes, all of the pieces are laid out. Each clue, the viewer can go along with Jessica, and there aren't any surprises. There aren't any secret bits that the writer is hiding that, you know, if we found out as the viewer beforehand, that we would figure out who the murderer was. These bits are all laid together like a real case. And the viewer, just like Jessica, can pick up all these little pieces that aren't even emphasized in the episode. But, like, Preston saying the New York Times reporter was a man, even though it was really a woman, those are pieces that can be picked up but aren't highlighted during the episode, just like a real murder case. So Jessica picks up those pieces and sees them just as the viewer does, which is really great. And this ending scene, Preston, standing there, a very dapper gentleman, distinguished silver fox, wearing his trench coat and a suit and a tie, and he's on one end of the pool, and Jessica is on the other end, explaining how he had to be the murderer, the guy she's clearly fallen for, and she's crying, but not undignified, like, she's crying in a dignified way. She is also in a trench coat. It's very, very well filmed. It's just two people, like, he's explaining his situation and being honest with her, and she's, like, it's very vulnerable. So, he then, when he reveals that he, in fact, did kill the PI, and he tells her why, he walks over to his gun cabinet that is an outdoor gun cabinet near his skeet shooting range, which, in the last episode, was established that the skeet shooting is right on the edge of the pool for some reason, but it just was. So he walks over to the gun cabinet, which is alluding to the fact that he might be going to shoot Jessica. He establishes why he killed the man, because this PI happened to be the one that didn't believe he died escaping prison in the first place all those years ago, and that he's been trying to follow and find him this whole time. And Preston got his revenge by ruining his three partners' financial lives. But he did it from, as he said, did it from a distance. But the detective figured that he was still alive because he couldn't have been a coincidence that the people that were responsible for those deaths at the house or whatever, the house collapsing, they figured he'd get his revenge, parallel to the Count of Monte Cristo. So the detective has been trailing him this whole time. The detective even changed his name. Preston had changed his name. This was years and years ago, I assume. Apparently, the detective recognized Preston, but Preston did not recognize the detective when he met him, and he didn't know he was in for blackmail until they met at the pool, which is interesting. So this detective has been collecting files on Preston all these years, or whatever his real name is, and he knew that if, because of this murder that he shot this man, because of the murder, that people would be looking into his files, like, he didn't want the police to get his files, so he was being blackmailed by the PI, because he knew that if the PI gave over the files to the actual police, that, clearly his life would be ruined. And that is why he dressed up the PI in the Sherlock Holmes costume, because he didn't want the suspicion to be on the PI, because they would have looked into the PI's records. So, I mean, clever, but also, like, the captain established that he put the Sherlock Holmes costume into the closet, which is weird to begin with. But, like, the only other person that probably opened the closet, unless that was a common thing, would have been, like, between that time frame, like, everyone was, like, super drunk, still partying. So, like, Preston opened the closet at some point, saw the costume, I don't know. Up until the point where he's finished talking about why he killed the PI and dressed him up as Sherlock Holmes, there's a light of, you kind of feel sorry for him. Like, you feel like you understand why he murdered the PI. The writing and filming makes you feel things for him. But, and the same with the way Jessica acts, the acting lets you sympathize with the killer, but then Jessica's like, you know, I like you and everything, but it's still not okay. And it's really interesting how that shifts. Like, he's like, I had to kill him, he's a dirty blackmailer, and she's like, okay, like, I get that, but also you killed the captain, and he's like, everyone hated him, he was a horrible human, blah, 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 and she's like, yeah, but, like, also, death isn't really what he deserved. Like, he may have been a horrible person, but still, like, the only reason he killed him was to cover his tracks, because, in order to believe that the target all along was the captain had to be killed eventually. Preston must have really liked Jessica, because she starts to cry, and she's like, I don't know whether to scream or cry, I'm very angry at you. And then she fucking turns her back to him. Well, he is next to the gun cabinet. Like, what are you even doing? But that honestly could have been a power play on her part. Because, like, she clearly came there to prove that he was the murderer. But, like, also, she could have easily been like, I want to show you that even though I know you're the murderer, I care about you. So she turns her back on him. And he walks up to her and places his hands on her shoulders from behind. And the camera pans up, kind of up from the water, looking up at them as if he's going to try and drown her. Which, honestly, is an idea. I never thought of that until that. I thought he was going to pull a gun out. But the camera work alone just suggested, no one said this, but the camera suggested that he was going to push her in the water, which is amazing camera work and just filming in general. So she leans her head back on him and he's like, you know, I'm sorry, in another life we could have been together. And she kind of freezes and is nervous because she realizes what a position she is in. But then he admits that he'll go talk to the police or whatever. He must really care for her because he straight up murdered just to keep his secret and then murdered another person to keep the same secret. That someone he's clearly friends with because he was at the party and used his coat closet. I'm referring to the captain. But he must really care about Jessica because at this point, or he realized that he's in too deep, they'll find out anyway. But he agrees to go to the police and ask Jessica to join him. So the viewer has to assume that's what happened because the next scene is Jessica and Grady at the train station a fucking again. And it's interesting because Kitty is not with them this time. And Jessica is like, I'm never coming back to New York. This is some bullshit. So we learn that she has been there 7 days. So this whole thing took place within 7 days. The funny thing is, Jessica's not mad that Preston is a murderer. She's mad that she found out. She says to Grady that she's mad at herself for being a busybody, for digging, for finding out. And then Grady's like, yeah, but then I would be on trial if not him. Which is a good point, but I think she doesn't want to blame Preston yet because she's still too into him. So she's kind of blaming herself at this point. So because Jessica solved the murder, Kitty comes running in, saying that the police, the New York police, need her help. They need her help. Apparently, two wrestlers, something found in the ring. There has to be a logical explanation. They're both found dead. Madison Square Garden. And she's like, bitch, no. Gets on the train and waves goodbye. And Kitty's like, what the fuck? Like, you just gave up solving more high-profile crimes. Which I think is funny that they're like, we need you. Which makes sense because, like, she's a famous person for solving mysteries. And it's been established that in her books, she's very, very meticulous regarding details and the little things, which is proven by her solving the murder mystery that she was confronted with that weekend. I don't think it's that far-fetched that she was asked to help because it was in the news and they're like, damn, we can't figure it out, so help us. So yeah, I don't think that's far-fetched. And then you think she's on the train. You fucking think she's gone. And then she comes back. And she's running, like, she ran through the halls of the train to meet back up with them. And then she's like, she realized what she heard, that two wrestlers were in the middle of Madison Square Garden, I think a wrestling ring, I forget what they said. And they drowned, but there's no water. And she's, like, really interested. So clearly she hasn't learned her lesson. And that right there, that her saying drowned, like, she just finished talking about how she was over murder, over mysteries, over solving things. The curiosity is getting the best of her, and that is her nature. That is wired inside of her. And that is the perfect ending to this, because she just freaking can't help herself. And that's the end of the two-part first episode of Murder, She Wrote, The Murder of Sherlock Holmes. And honestly, I loved it, and I hope you enjoyed my, well, I pretty much, instead of, not just analyzed it, but I also, like, told it frame for frame. But I hope, if you haven't seen Murder, She Wrote, that entices you to watch some more episodes. I think there are 12 or 13 seasons of it, so we have a lot to go. So yeah, thanks for watching Murder, She Spoke, or not watching, but thanks for listening to Murder, She Spoke, and I hope you stay tuned. The next episode, let me see, is episode 3, Deadly Lady.